Listener supported. WNYC Studios. Today, on a special Snap Judgment, we're going to shake it up. In collaboration with the New York Times, we pursue a family mystery, a mystery that began decades ago. 1962, in a small suburb outside of Chicago, Illinois. But we begin a generation later, when Amy Sandberg was quite literally cleaning out her mother's closet. Snap Judgment.
As we got to kind of towards the end of the closet, up to the top shelves, I reached around to feel for anything to see if there's anything we had missed, and I found a plastic bag, and I pulled it down, and there inside the bag was a very small, white, what appeared to be baptismal dress. I knew right away it wasn't mine because I knew I hadn't been baptized. My brothers had been baptized, but I hadn't been baptized. And I also could see that it wouldn't have fit me because I was 12 pounds at birth and this dress was pretty tiny. I held up the dress and to show my aunt, who was standing there with me, and I said, "Do you know anything about this? Whose dress is this?" And she looked at it and she goes, "It's Rebecca's."
Did you know who Rebecca was?
So when I was a kid, 9 or 10 years old, one of my brothers let it slip that he had had a sister before me. So I ran into the house and I found my mom. She was sitting at the kitchen table, and I said, is it true that you had a girl before me? I could see that she was kind of surprised that I asked the question, and took her a minute to collect herself. She said, "Listen carefully, because I'm only going to tell you this story once. Your dad and I couldn't have children, and that we had adopted Stephen and Bobby, and we very much wanted a girl, so we decided to adopt a girl next. When the baby was given to us as an infant, she was ruddy." And I remember that word very well because I remember looking up the definition of ruddy later because I didn't know what it meant. She decided to take the baby to our pediatrician. And when she brought the baby to Dr. Kamen, he thought that the baby was black.
This is Leonard Sandberg. The lawyer and a nurse came with the baby to the house to deliver the baby to us. It was really not a big problem for us. We had two preceding kids who were adopted, and everything went very smooth. And in this case, we assumed that everything would go smooth until we looked at the baby. We're going fine.
Did you specifically ask for to adopt a white baby?
No. Never occurred to me.
Well, why wouldn't it occur to you?
Because I assumed the baby would be white.
And when did you realize that she was black?
Immediately, when we looked at her.
What did you see?
A black baby.
And did you ask about that when they dropped the baby off?
Well, we were amazed and surprised. I was absolutely dumbfounded. Both of us, Marge, my wife, and I both were dumbfounded when we looked at the baby. Obviously, that was a big deal.
Why did the baby being black concern you?
In our situation, having a Negro baby would be very difficult, to say the least. We lived in a completely lily-white area. During the time that this happened, it wouldn't have been a good idea.
Can you imagine what it would have been like for this baby to have grown up in all-white Deerfield?
It would have been very difficult. Not impossible. We would have coped. She would have been the only African-American in the community. Growing up, it might have been very difficult for her.
And the boys?
And the whole family. It could have been a mess.
My mom very much wanted to keep Rebecca, that she told me that she loved her and had bonded with her and did not want to let her go. And my dad, he wanted to give Rebecca back. He wanted to give Rebecca up. My dad eventually won the argument, and that's when they decided to return Rebecca. So what my mom told me was that social workers came to the house and they picked up Rebecca. And I remember my mom crying when she got to this part of the story and having difficulty finishing the story.
Is it your understanding, am I getting this right, that it left a kind of a sadness or a darkness in your mom?
Absolutely. I feel like there was always this sort of hovering sadness. Even though she put on a good face, it seemed like she felt like a sad person most of the time.
So I've known you for 55 years, and the first word to describe you wouldn't be sentimental. But did you experience any heartbreak over the baby being taken away?
It was definitely moving, and I felt really, really bad. We then made arrangements or set out right away to get another baby. Which was you.
I know this is speculative, but if it had been today, do you think you would have been okay with adopting a black baby?
Of course. No question whatsoever. I have no qualm about it.
What's changed?
Oh, the times have changed.
Can you tell me what Deerfield was like at this time?
It was small. When I was a little girl, there was maybe 12,000 residents. It was an all-white community, and it was very racially tense. There had been this housing controversy in 1959.
A few years before baby Rebecca came to the Sandbergs, the town had been rocked by a pretty ugly racial controversy. A developer had made plans to build an integrated housing complex, and the majority of townspeople rallied against it and got it shut down. There was a jeering town meeting. The whole thing made national headlines. There were a few people in Deerfield who stood up in favor of the integrated housing, including Amy's parents and a local pastor. They very much saw themselves as progressives. And these people were harassed. A cross was burned on someone's lawn. The pastor, Paul Berggren, was so upset about the town's racist response that he actually made an announcement. He said he was going to adopt a black baby. And it did not go over well. This is his daughter, Deborah. She was a student at Deerfield High at the time.
I actually am looking right now at an article from 1960, and it says, white pastor in Deerfield asked to adopt Negro child. And I remember specifically that I came into the lunchroom, and as I went to sit down, these other girls said that I couldn't sit there because my dad was a commie and an N-lover. Another article that I've come across has the headline, "Warned on Adopting Negro, Minister Threatened."
They got a bomb threat.
I know my mother then became skittish about really pursuing this adoption of a black child, because what it could mean for the entire family, and was it best for that adoptive child. So I think my mother was the one that finally just said, we need to let this go.
You had brothers who were little boys when the baby was brought home, right?
Right. So they would have been about, Bobby would have been 5 at the time, and Steve would have been 8 at the time Rebecca was brought home.
My name is Steven Sandberg, and I'm about to tell a story about a sister I had that I don't have anymore. Her name was Becky, and I don't know too much about what's happened to her over the years, but what I know about her was wonderful, but very short-lived. I can remember my dad sitting in a chair, TV chair, and I could still remember my dad getting in that chair and holding on to Becky and curled up in the chair and falling asleep in front of the TV with her. I remember my parents every night kept the windows and the blinds shut most of the time. It's like my parents didn't want anybody to know we were home. And I knew that there was trouble in the town, but I didn't understand then how it related to my sister and our family. And I just, to this day, it just feels like it just wasn't right. It wasn't normal. It shouldn't have happened. And they took my sister. It was wrong. It was all of a sudden one day, several people showed up, and my mom had her wrapped in blankets and everything else, and would let her go. They'd basically pry her out of my mom's hands. And they just didn't hardly say anything. They just walked out. And I didn't understand at all what was going on. And my mom just told me that Becky's gone and she's not going to come back. And that was it. It was very, very cold. After they left, I sat on the step outside. It seemed like for hours with my mom. I'm sorry, holding her hand because she was so upset. And all she would say is, they took my baby. They took my baby. That's all she would say. I kept saying, I'm sorry, Mom. I didn't know what to do.
Your dad seems to say it was his choice to return Rebecca, but Steve is talking as though some outside force came and took Rebecca.
I think that Steve's 8-year-old mind couldn't understand what the adults were thinking. I think he saw his baby sister being forcibly taken out of my mom's hands and people leaving with her.
When we lost Rebecca, it changed my parents. My parents traveled all over the world and were very close and loved each other very much. And when we lost Becky, I believe that it ultimately led to their divorce. We had conversations shortly before she died. And she still, on her deathbed, couldn't believe that something like that happened to her, because she was such a strong believer in treating everybody the same and equality, that she was almost like 50 years of shock that this could happen to her, and actually did happen to her, and it still affected her 50 years later. Dad and I have talked about it, and he seems to think that she was only there 2 or 3 weeks, or a much shorter period of time than I do. And I can tell you that I just don't think Dad remembers what happened. But I just remember it was cold, and it was spring when we got Rebecca. And I remember it was the middle of summer. It started getting very hot. I truly believe that she was with us about 3 months. And I know it was very shortly after that we got my sister Amy.
Let's touch on this. When I first told you that I was going to search for Rebecca, can you describe your reaction to that news?
I felt that it was digging up an unpleasant part of my past that I really had completely forgotten about and didn't really want to relive.
What changed your mind?
You wanted to go forward with it. It was okay.
But was it okay with him?
Not initially.
What did he do? How did he react?
he just shut it down. He didn't want to talk about it. He says, I don't want you to do that. That's foolish. And he said to me, I just want you to know that if you decide to go ahead with this, there will be consequences and I will not have anything to do with you.
Whoa.
Yeah. And my brothers then stopped talking to me as well.
So why did you, did you think about not doing it?
Never.
Why did you want to do it?
I feel like at that point I was pretty obsessed with finding out if she was okay. Like, I wanted to do it for my mom, mostly. About the same time I found the baptismal dress while I was going through my mom's things, I also found a bunch of her diaries. She had written, my mom had written about thinking of Rebecca, praying for her having had a good life and good outcomes and a loving family. And, you know, it's just something that she walked around with. It was a burden that she carried. And this diary entry was from 1993. And she was still thinking about Rebecca, you know, 31 years later. And I wanted to answer that question. Like, I wanted to know that she was okay.
Amy had three clues when she began her search. A tiny picture of baby Rebecca, and a rough idea of the year and the time of year that Rebecca was born.
Well, a couple people said that it was not long after.
My husband and I went to the Cook County Law Library in downtown Chicago.
Okay, so yeah, it might be 1960. It could possibly conceivably be 62. I would definitely go there before I go 58. But it's likely it could be May if she was adopted in April.
We went into this little room where they had several microfiche machines looking for a petition to adopt.
Did you do May of 62?
How long did you guys spend in that library?
We spent 7 hours in the library. And at 4:30, a half an hour before the library closed.
Holy moly.
Whoa. And we were almost out of here.
Jeez.
And we both saw it, like, at the same time.
Crazy.
That's funny that you just came over here.
My heart's beating so rapidly right now.
When Snap Judgment returns, the stunning conclusion to finding Rebecca. If you missed even a moment, subscribe to the Snap Judgment Storytelling Podcast at snapjudgment.org. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
This episode of Snap Judgment is supported by Manscaped, offering precision-engineered men's grooming tools. Manscaped has redesigned the electric trimmer with their new Lawnmower 3.0. This third-generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce accidents, along with an LED light and an intelligently designed charging dock that's powered by USB. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SNAP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code SNAP.
Snap Judgment supported by Mercari. Got stuff lying around you just don't use? Check out Mercari. It's an app that makes it fast and easy to sell almost anything. You take a few pics, add a description, and your item is listed just like that. Mercari will even email you a shipping label when it sells, so there are no meetups with strangers. Don't let the stuff you don't use go to waste. Sell or buy almost anything on Mercari. Find Mercari on the app stores or on Mercari.com. That's Mercari.
News organizations have always relied on police sources for information. But what happens when those sources are wrong?
Local news in New York City don't really have time to check this story. They're just being told cops were intentionally poisoned at a Shake Shack. I mean, that story tells itself.
Shame it didn't fact check itself. Join us for this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment. Today, in collaboration with the New York Times, Snap Judgment traces the history of one little girl.
Holy moly.
Whoa.
My heart's beating so rapidly right now. So we don't know if that was... So we don't know if that was her father's name or her mother's name, though. This petition right here, that's the petition number.
Yeah, right.
Now we have to figure out, can we get our hands on the petition?
Right.
As she gathered information, Amy worked with a woman she called the Adoption Whisperer, a kind of expert detective on all things adoption, Melissa Mitchell. Together, they narrowed down names and dates in Melissa's living room.
Smith. Angel, A-N-G-E-L-L-E, it looks like. I had a client named Angel Smith. There's probably a million Angel Smiths.
We then had five or six names to work with, and we started to Google each of those names and just trying to look for some online footprint of each of those people.
When I left the hospital 2 days later,
I found a blog post.
Smith has their angel. This is posted by Angel... In parentheses, angel, like the heavenly angel, Kimberly Smith. Huh? I've been angel all my life.
I think there's no doubt we have the right person here, though.
In a very crazy coincidence, Melissa, this adoption whisperer, realized she knew Angel Smith, the woman they had found. So normally it would be against protocol to just call this found adoptee out of the blue. But since Melissa knew her, they picked up the phone.
Hello? Yeah, I'm looking for Angel Smith. I don't know if you remember me or if you're the Angel Smith I remember working with. I'm looking.
So my biggest fear was that I would... my biggest fear was that I wouldn't find Rebecca, that I would search and not find her.
I help adoptees find their... Angel... I'm great, but you just are not going to believe why I'm calling. It's going to rock your
closely
world.
Behind that, my second biggest fear was that I would find her, but she wouldn't want to be found and that she would be upset with the news that I was delivering.
Wait. So was she adopted?
She was, okay. I know you are. So let me start again. There was a baby whose name was Monica Gordon, and she was placed with a family in Chicago, Mr. and Mrs. Sandberg.
A white family.
Correct. Did you ever know about this?
Are you freaking out?
Yeah. I was pacing like a caged cat while Melissa was talking to her.
I'm going to pass you now to Amy Roost. I'm going to let her take over the phone now, okay?
Hi, Angel.
Hi, Amy. How are you? Bless you.
I'm shaking a little bit right now. How about you?
Girl, you know I am. I mean, I'm so excited right now. And I was in the 99-cent store waiting for my husband to come out of the doctor's office. And he's just browsing up and down the line. I left my whole basket, ran out of the store, and I'm now sitting in my car.
Oh, wow. Well.
This is absolutely. Are you sure it's me?
We're positive. So, Angel, let me tell you a little bit of the story and fill in some of the information that Melissa...
When you first got on the phone with her, like, what did you tell her at first? Were you trying to, like, ease into it?
I did ease into it.
So my parents adopted you, and they were told that your parents were both white. And you were very light-skinned, and they didn't know until a couple of weeks later, when you continued to get darker, they took you to a pediatrician, and the pediatrician thought you might be biracial. And this is where the story...
It's good.
Well, this is where the story gets a little dicey. But I want, before I tell you the rest of the story, what I want to tell you first is that in Deerfield in 1962, there was extreme racism. There was extreme racial tensions.
All over the world, it was... Racism still is.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. But
let me just give you a hint so you don't have to worry.
Okay.
I was chosen by and for my
parents. It was immediately clear that Angel had been adopted by a wonderful family.
My parents, my mother very, very much wanted to keep you. My dad felt that it would be unfair to his sons, my brothers, and to you.
Everybody.
To you. To raise you in an all-white community in 1962.
And Angel was shockingly receptive to this news about herself.
Yeah, so I was, you know, naturally I was very worried. You're my sister, exactly.
And at some point, she said, you know, my head is just reeling and I need to get off the phone. Can we talk later? Then we eventually made a plan to meet.
Did you tell your dad?
So I called my dad and I left a message on his voicemail saying, you know, Angel's coming to town and she would love to meet you. I hope that you'll be able to meet with us. Maybe we could have brunch together on Sunday. And a couple days went by, and then on Saturday he called and he said, okay, let's meet for brunch. I felt a mixture of tension and relief. And my dad's 89 and he's very fit, but he was looking very small. She went up to him and tapped him on the shoulder and held out her arms and gave him a giant hug. We were seated at our table. We ordered a round of mimosas and she began telling us about her life.
I've heard this
right out of the hospital.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'd heard the story. I knew that I was biracial and that that my family, they had expected me to be white. Well, I didn't know that they were talking about
you. Talked about how at the beginning of your search you were wanting to see if she was okay. Do you feel like you were like trying to show your dad, look, she's okay? Her life turned out okay.
I mean, I will say this. I did feel some responsibility for the meeting going well. I remember taking some pride in little parts of her stories that I wanted to make sure she shared with my dad.
I was in private school, and we had a summer home in Union Pier, Michigan, and a home in Chicago, so she had two mortgages.
Angel hit the family lottery. After leaving the Sandbergs, she was adopted by Ruth and Harry Smith. A black couple. They lived in a middle-class black neighborhood. They owned a stationery store. They had a large network of loving friends and family.
And she shared with us about her childhood, how she had been very close to her parents and grown up in this wonderful community where, you know, she was thought of it as, you know, a village.
And then when she was 8, her dad suddenly died. She left her small private school. She and her mom moved to Los Angeles. They no longer had their village of supportive friends.
And then the story took this very distressing turn because she began to explain how when she got to Los Angeles, she got introduced to cocaine. And
I can't honestly say that I was running from anything or hiding from anything. I just liked the way cocaine tasted.
Really liked it and started doing more cocaine and eventually ended up becoming homeless and living on the streets. And she told us about her HIV diagnosis.
So I disappeared for 10 years. No one heard from me. No one had a clue where I was. No one would ever believe that I was homeless.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, a whiplash listening to her story from, you know, very stable, loving childhood in a loving family, exactly what my mom wished for, to just making some bad choices. You know, I just remember listening and just I could see my dad's face. It was a hard story to hear. So the conversation came back around to the decision to return Rebecca,
which is how all of this happened. I'm so grateful. I can't even imagine growing up in Deerfield, the only black kid.
Yeah, I mean, can you just imagine what her life would have been like? I mean,
how
you imagine it because, like,
the only black child in the whole community.
And look at this hair.
The persecution.
No. It would have been a problem in this. Probably, absolutely.
I have always been very grateful for whoever you were. Now that I know who you are, is wonderful. You know, I always wanted to be able to say thank you. You know, because you never know how people are going to perceive things. No. And I just wanted you to know that, you know, my parents were ever grateful. I am so grateful. Huh. And it passes on to Amy. I just love her, the fact that she had the kind of heart to find me, you know, to look for me is just, you know, it speaks volumes. I'm sure.
There's something about this tape that's uncomfortable of this brunch. Can you name it?
Well, listening to the tape, you know, like I didn't feel what I'm about to tell you at the brunch, but listening to the tape, the part that made me feel uncomfortable was, I think we are all trying to rationalize what happened. My parents' decision that it was for the best. And it may very well have been for the best. And I know Angel believes it was for the best. But I felt like there was an attempt to gloss over and make everybody sort of assuage everybody's guilt about what had taken place.
There's so much reassuring going on.
Exactly.
When you, Angel, when you knew you were going to meet Len Sandberg for that first time, did you have any hopes or any fears?
Oh, girl, no, I don't live on fear. I was so excited to be able to thank him and to what I thought would probably free him from any type of ignorance, shall I say. When I say ignorance, I mean him not knowing me, not knowing how I would respond, how I had, you know, ingested the whole incident, the whole experience, who I had become. You know what I'm saying? I could dispel all of those notions. He would finally get to see, this is me. This is who I am. I'm really grateful. From the bottom of my heart, I am so grateful.
And are you okay with like that being on you to validate that for him? Did you feel like you had a responsibility to make him comfortable, to reassure him that you're okay?
No, that wasn't my responsibility, but I knew that it would happen. You know, it comes with a certain level of, excuse me, did I make the right choice? Yeah, and especially, you know, when you're checking your moral compass. You know what I'm saying? Because it was about race. You know, we can't pretend that it wasn't. It was about race. And what does that say about me as a human being? I can attest to, hey, it was all good. It was okay. You made the right choice, dude, and I'm the only one who could have validated that for him. You know, like I explained to him, I said, hey, look, it's like this. If I were to order a dress on the internet, and then they send me, instead of sending me a red dress because I have this gorgeous red bag and shoes, and they send me a little black dress, cute little black dress, but it doesn't go with my ensemble. So it's got to go back. It's got to go back. And when I shared that with him, he was like, what? And I said,
I mean, that is a crazy thing. That's a little, I'm like, what too, Angel? Like, it's a little bit of a crazy thing to say. You were human.
Come on. And I'm still human, you know? And I am still human, and I do have a brain. You know what I'm saying? Come on, seriously. You have a white family and a white community. Didn't nobody order a little black child to throw into this mix?
Did you ever for a moment not have that like positive perspective on it? Was learning this part of your story ever, I don't know, hard to swallow, or did it make you feel any kind of way?
Never. You know, I was adopted or chosen twice before I was 1 month old. You know, I could be one, oh, poor me, nobody wanted me. No, it took the right people to deal with me, you know.
What do you think you would have done had you been in the Sandbergs?
What kind of question is that? What would you have done if you had been at the Sandbergs? You know what I'm saying? Yeah, what would you have done? You know, who knows? Who knows?
I felt that morally I was probably wrong. Maybe practically I was right, but morally I was wrong, I think. And I should have been stronger, perhaps, and gone forward with it. I didn't. And I felt guilty.
We'd like to thank Angel Smith, Amy Roost, the Sandbergs, Leonard and Stephen for inviting us on this journey with them. We wish you all peace and healing going forward. Big love to Nick Jackson and KPBS in San Diego. This story is produced in collaboration with the New York Times. The original score is performed and created by Renzo Gorio. We'll have a link to Amy's website and the New York Times article on our website, snapjudgment.org. This story is produced by Amy Roost and Anna Sussman. Snappers, if you missed even a moment, you have to hear the entire thing. Subscribe to the podcast. However you get your podcast, get this one. Snapjudgment.org. Let the people know, I'm super proud of the team that made it happen. The Uber producer, Mark Ristich, and I want to show some love to one of the finest radio producers the world has ever known, Anna Sussman. The beatmaster, Pat Mesiti-Miller, Joe Rosenberg, reads backwards. Shayna Sheely reads textbooks. Renzo Gorio reads manuals. Eliza Smith reads romance novels. Adiza Egan reads fortunes. Liz Mack reads maps. Renzo Gorio reads minds. Leon Morimoto reads the road. Taylor Cott reads the season, and Jasmine Aguilera reads the signs. Now, perhaps you've heard from random strangers on the street that this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could track down one of those random strangers, threaten to beat the truth out of them, but in the end, they will still declare that even though you can't be further away from the news than this is WNYC.